From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And first, a scene setter. In the coronavirus task force briefing today, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said, we're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. And the White House is presenting an $850 billion emergency stimulus package to stem the economic crisis. Also today, no voting in Ohio. The Democratic primary was postponed over concerns about COVID-19. In Florida, Illinois, and Arizona, voters are going to the polls. Officials say hand sanitizer is available. Stay 6 feet away from each other, people. Meanwhile, 7 million people in San Francisco are sheltering in place. More on that later in the program. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo said there's no plan to quarantine residents of New York City, but he's working on getting temporary hospital facilities up and running in the state. And in Louisville, the Kentucky Derby was postponed until September. The first time since World War II, the race will not take place the first Saturday in May.
And scientists around the world are racing to develop treatments and a vaccine. One team of researchers in Canada has come one step closer by isolating the virus responsible for the pandemic. And joining me now is one of them. Dr. Aaron J. Banerjee is a fellow at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And doctor, what exactly were you able to do in the lab, and what are you learning about this coronavirus?
So, you know, the first step of testing a vaccine or testing a drug is really getting the virus out of clinical specimens so you can grow up the virus and then you can test it. And that's what we did. So we took clinical specimens and we grew them up on cells in a lab. Now that makes all of these resources available for the scientists across Canada.
And how were you able to isolate this virus?
So what we essentially did was viruses like cells. So when you take a virus and you put them in these cells, which is what we did from clinical specimens from COVID-19 patients, we took the samples, we put them on cells, and then we got the virus out of these cells. And we are characterizing the virus as we speak.
Mm. You've been able to examine this virus in great detail. Can you explain for us what makes this coronavirus different from the others? Did you get any insight on why it's spreading so quickly and why it's so harmful?
Right. So if you look at other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS, those are nastier viruses than this coronavirus. We are lucky and we are grateful that this coronavirus is not as lethal in humans like other coronaviruses. But you're right. It does seem to be more transmissible and we don't know yet. But we are hoping in the next few weeks we'll figure out why this virus is more transmissible.
The question that everyone has, and I know it's why you're working so hard on this, is this going to lead to a cure or vaccine against this coronavirus?
Right. So that's really the dream. Everybody's working very hard to get that vaccine or the therapeutic or drugs, like you said. What will happen sooner than a vaccine would be a drug that you can use to treat these COVID-19 patients. Because vaccines have to go through regulatory processes and it takes time. But if you can take drugs that are FDA approved, and now that we've isolated this virus, you can test the efficacy of those drugs using the virus we've isolated. And if you can identify any kind of cross-protection, you can start using those drugs. So that's really the goal, I think.
Yeah. What's the most important thing right now, scientifically speaking, as you work through this process? What other work needs to be done?
I think, you know, very simple questions like how effective are the disinfectants that people are using? Right. So this is something you cannot test any of these questions without having live virus. And we are going to supply this virus and share it once we've characterized it. Dr. Samira Mubarak at Sunnybrook, who's the team I was working with, and she's been leading all these efforts. I think she's very nice with sharing stuff. And we've decided that we will share it once we've characterized it.
That's Dr. Aaron J. Banerjee, part of a team of researchers that isolated the coronavirus causing COVID-19 last week. Dr. Banerjee, thank you so much for your time.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, love to share everything we can. So, you know, we've got this. There's nothing to worry about.
Oh, well, that is very reassuring to hear. It really is.
You know, everyone's panicking and a little bit of hope during these times. It's great.
Yeah. So you feel pretty confident that we will contain this?
I think just with social distancing and washing hands and with all the lockdowns that's happening, I think we'll be okay.
Thank you so much for that, doctor.
Thanks, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Well, I needed that too. And here in the States, another group of researchers says they're close to a treatment that might stave off the worst effects of COVID-19 and also work to prevent it. And it's one that was used over 100 years ago. Dr. Peter Hotez is a professor of molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. He's been a key player in vaccine research for diseases including SARS and the new coronavirus. He tweeted out our awful new reality and said he's determined to explain and promote convalescent serum antibody treatment, especially to save the lives of first responders. He's a busy man, what with trying to save lives, so we reached him on his cell at Baylor. Dr. Hotez, explain, what is convalescent serum antibody treatment?
So this is actually a throwback therapy that was used during the 1918 flu pandemic, and it involves taking serum from patients who recovered from the virus because it has potentially a high level of antibodies, isolating the antibodies and giving it back to either sick patients or now potentially could be used for healthcare workers in a lower dose in order to protect them from a couple of weeks of getting the infection. It's an idea that's being actively promoted by Arturo Casadevall, who's a friend and colleague at Johns Hopkins Medical Center. And what he's doing is trying to organize a network of medical centers to see if we can gear up blood banks to make this happen.
Yeah, and we know that doctors in China have begun treating COVID-19 patients with this blood that's harvested from survivors, again, because if they survived, they built up antibodies. Now, is there a danger, though? I mean, you know, what could be the downside of injecting them with antibodies?
So we're only talking about isolating the antibodies so that there's little to no risk of actually injecting them with the virus. There are some potential risks that have been associated with this, including potential lung injury, but it seems to be an uncommon complication. And the point is, if we're looking at large numbers of patients in intensive care units or very sick individuals, if it has an opportunity to lower mortality, that could make a big difference to the nation. It's really a stopgap measure until, you know, we can develop our vaccines and other groups can develop their vaccines, or if we have a new drug available. It's very challenging to develop new technologies to a new pathogen in the middle of a very dangerous epidemic. We don't have a lot of precedent for doing that.
Well, it's fascinating because this serum would be injecting, as you said, antibodies that were built up in the blood that defeated the virus. But to be clear, are you talking about this as a treatment for somebody within the first few days of them, you know, showing symptoms? Or are you advocating this or hoping this might work also as a prevention?
So it's really both. And it's partly a function of the dose that they receive. So if somebody is very sick with this virus and you're worried about them having progressive disease, the idea you would give them a large amount of the antibody. But in theory, and in some cases in practice, it's been shown that you could give much smaller doses in order to administer this to people that are high risk for exposure to the virus. We think about frontline healthcare workers, and we've already seen that. We had a report this weekend of two emergency room physicians now in who are severely ill or even in the ICU with this virus. We cannot let that happen on a large scale, so maybe the antibody could be used for that purpose. We're going to need guidance for this from the federal government, how to best provide quality control for this technology, how to regulate it, potentially bring in the Food and Drug Administration, who has a lot of expertise in biologics. Also, what kind of regulatory oversight does this need to have? And also, could we get the federal government to mobilize some resources for blood banks?
Well, you mentioned the two emergency room doctors, one's in New Jersey, one's in Washington State, in critical condition. And, you know, many of us read the incredible piece in the New York Times this past weekend about the two 29-year-old doctors from Wuhan. One didn't make it, one did. But it really drove home what happens during this illness and what the fear is.
Well, you know, there are a lot of medical mysteries about this virus, and one of them that was reported out of China is that healthcare workers seem to disproportionately be susceptible to severe illness based on what you'd predict just on their age. You can imagine how incredibly destabilizing that would be in the United States if healthcare workers are going to work every day knowing that they could become severely ill and be taken care of by their colleagues. Things could unravel very quickly.
Right.
So for me, this is a national priority.
Yeah, you are particularly saying we can save the lives of these frontline health providers, first responders, potentially with something that will slow down this virus's march through their bodies.
I think it's a weak link in our health system right now that if we have a substantial number of healthcare workers taken out of the workforce, and I think this needs to be prioritized now that we're moving on to the next stage of the epidemic.
Yeah, and during the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918, scientists reported that these transfusions of, you know, taking the blood from survivors of that flu led to a 50% drop in their deaths. Here we are, over 100 years later, thinking about this again. That's Dr. Peter Hotez, professor of molecular virology and microbiology at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. I'm Dr. Hotez. We wish you all the best with this. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So, hopeful news, treatments possible. But we're wondering, how are you doing with all of this? How are the outbreak, which hasn't really even hit us yet, and the restrictions because of it? How's this all hitting you? Weigh in, hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
And COVID-19 is already having a profound impact on the music industry. Not only was South by Southwest canceled, but Coachella was canceled as well. And Live Nation, one of the largest musical promoters in the country, has postponed concerts through the end of the month. Joining me now is Brian Keir, Artistic Director of the World Music Institute. Brian, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
And Brian, your organization brings musicians from all over the world for concerts. What kind of impact have you already seen?
This has had an impact that of just collapsing tours, shows that have been canceled on one end or the other of the dates. So it's had major repercussions. And now, of course, it's definitely cramping venues and all sorts of industries within the music industry.
You were also in the concert business during the terrorist attacks of 9/11. How does today's crisis compare?
Back then, I know a lot of my colleagues doing international music and bringing world music and that to the United States felt that the music must go on, and especially at that time of a lot of prejudice and so forth, that we felt that it was really important to bring the music of other cultures and importantly. But now we don't even have that luxury of trying to keep bringing people and music of other cultures together. So it's had a much more profound impact now, I would say, than the 9/11 attacks and that, because 9/11, if you remember, there we were shut down for a few weeks of international flights, but there were venues and concerts and that were able to happen, unlike now. So it's a different day.
How are you advising musicians? Of course, you're letting them know about their schedules, but there's probably also an emotional component to your job and having to interface with them.
It's really just having a ripple effect of for these artists of making a living, because as you know now, I mean, an artist can't make a living off of streaming services and so forth. So the live industry has been the way that they've been making their bread and butter. So it's really had a devastating effect on live musicians, of course. So, yeah. I mean, as an organization, we hope to reschedule and get artists back in if they can, of course. But it's going to be starting over, so to speak, of getting these tours together. And it takes a lot for artists to even get a handful of dates in the United States to make tours happen. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge puzzle that, has to be reshaped and reshifted. And now we're just waiting for the next steps and It's an interesting time.
Brian Keir is the Artistic Director of the World Music Institute. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Tanya.
There were nearly 2,000 musical acts scheduled to perform at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas this year. Madison McFerrin was one of those acts scheduled to play. She's a singer-songwriter from Brooklyn, New York, and if her name sounds familiar, it's because she's the daughter of music legend Bobby McFerrin. Well, since Madison won't be playing at South by Southwest, we thought we'd have her here, albeit remotely. Madison McFerrin, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you're at home now, and you've had to cancel most of your live events. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm just trying to adjust to the new normal of things because, you know, everything's postponed for the time being, but nobody really knows till when or how long. And being a musician, live shows are how you make the majority of your income. So now it's time to regroup and rework how we're going to do that for the next couple months.
You made your debut at South by Southwest in 2018. It's where a lot of national critics heard your sound for the first time. How important is South by Southwest for you and artists like you who are just starting out?
It's an incredibly important festival. I mean, there are so many people there who you network with, who you get to work with. So it's an incredibly important festival, especially as an independent musician, to be able to have the kind of outreach that really help jumpstart your career in many ways. So to have such an important festival not happen this year is really telling as to the severity of what we're facing.
Your first hit was called No Time to Lose, and Questlove actually called your first album Soul Capella. Let's take a listen.
You didn't want it before, so why are you here waiting? I don't understand why you think I am contemplating on ways for you to love again. Everything that you're missing, saying a premonition, got you a change in your mind. Boy, stop your reminiscing, cause I won't play the fool again.
Soul Capella, I mean, that's a really cool description.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty neat. I stole it from him afterwards.
You did? Now you say it, yeah. We know your dad, Bobby McFerrin, as a talented unaccompanied artist. I can only assume that he has had a huge influence on your music, but what inspired you to make your debut album, Finding Foundation Volume 1, an a cappella album?
I really just did it out of necessity. It was not something that I was intending to do. I had this loop pedal, and I was messing around with it. And I used to play my solo shows with the loop pedal and also with a synthesizer. And when I started getting some more shows that called for a shorter set time, I had noticed that people were really attracted to these a cappella songs that I was putting out. But I mean, it's really just the case that I hear harmony in my head better than I can play it on an instrument. So I was like, let me just that for the time being. I would imagine that being at several Bobby McFerrin concerts throughout my life has influenced that in some way.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, you also have a famous grandfather, Robert McFerrin Sr., who was the first Black man to sing in the Metropolitan Opera. I can only imagine how much music is infused in your day-to-day life and your life growing up. Has that put a lot of pressure on you, though, or is it just part of a big family that loves to sing and pursue music seriously?
It's a bit of both. It's definitely started out just as, you know, this is what we do as a family. And, you know, my dad's singing in the house all the time and we listen to music all the time. And then it wasn't really until I went to college at Berklee College of Music. Up until that point, you know, it's easy to take for granted the fact that you have a musical genius in your household. And so then all of a sudden I began listening to my father's music really from a musician's perspective and not just as his daughter. And it really opened my eyes and my ears to the brilliance of what he does and made me incredibly grateful to have someone like him in my life.
On your newest EP, You and I, you actually recorded one of the songs while playing your dad's baby grand piano. It's called Know You Better. Let's take a listen.
Tables are turning, must be the speed. It's got me over-observing under your light.
What a beautiful tonal quality you have. Tell me a little bit more about this song.
I really started doing a cappella stuff live because I was too nervous to play piano and sing in a live setting, just because I haven't been as confident in my piano playing abilities. And so it was just kind of a reaffirming, like, hey, I actually can do this, and I also don't need to just do the acapella thing. I also don't need to have a bunch of production around me. Like, I can just do this like this. I can, and it's also a live take. That was just, you know, one take all the way through, with me playing the piano and singing at the same time. So I was like, hey, if you ever had any doubts that I can sing, here you go.
One of your songs is a little bit of a departure. It's called Try. Let's listen.
But no sacrifice comes without mistakes, and we could fly, take a leap of faith, it's time to decide, try.
What's driving this new sound? Is it an evolution? Is it an experiment? Tell me more about it.
It actually stems from an argument that my boyfriend and I got into, and he wrote try in capital letters on a piece of paper and slammed it down and then walked out of our apartment. And when I was writing the song, I actually wrote it in my dad's studio, and I was thinking about, you know, this concept of really trying to push yourself and try and be your best self, and I just kept saying try over and over, and like that argument kept coming back to me, and so I decided to title it that. And you know, I struggle with my own issues of insecurities and anxieties that seem to be so popular in this day and age, and just wanted everybody else to know that they're not alone in that, and if we just, you know, put our best foot forward, we can actually get through these things, including COVID-19.
I know. It's really part of the human condition, right? Is like we get back up and we try each day. Each day we try to attain and get to that level that we're trying to get to of whatever perfection looks like for us or being better looks like for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all of us are really trying to figure out how we're going to shift in this day and age. But, you know, I think this is going to be a real test to us as a society as to how we can stay together, stay connected, and not just let this social distancing distance us, you know, forever. Just because we can't be in the same place doesn't mean that we can't still share music. It doesn't mean that we can't still, you know, spread joy, and, you know, just be together in this collective community.
That's singer songwriter Madison McFerrin. Madison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And stay safe out there.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Cause your love's got me going in. You know you belong in my bed. I can't get you off of my brain.
Nearly 7 million people in the San Francisco Bay Area are now under an order to shelter in place for the next 3 weeks. It's the most drastic measure taken in the U.S. so far to slow the spread of coronavirus. And the region's main industry, tech, is also adjusting to this clampdown. Let's bring in Jessica Lesson. She's editor-in-chief of The Information. And Jessica, how is this shelter-in-place order affecting the tech sector? It's supposed to stay in place until at least April 7th.
It was quite a jolt yesterday. So we're only a couple hours into it. And I think everyone's trying to figure it out. You know, for a week or so now, companies out in the Bay Area, Google, Facebook, and many more have moved to work from home. But there are some huge questions about how this is going to affect technology companies, from small startups all the way on up. So, you know, it's pretty widespread. And these companies are enacting that across the country as well. It's very large numbers. I'm personally surprised my internet is holding up so well, among other things. But it's a complete upending of normal business practice, which, of course, we're seeing across other industries as well.
Yeah. You mentioned some of those smaller companies that don't typically have people working from home. How are they handling this? What's the learning curve been like?
I mean, it's a lot of Slack and Zoom, and I would say I was a casual Slack user, and now I'm a very aggressive Slack user. I think technology has given us a lot of tools. There's over Zoom and video conference, even just these like casual happy hour conversations that pop up between venture capitalists and startups and journalists. So there's a lot of creativity, I would say, but we are only in the beginning of this. And I think it's very unclear what it's going to feel like a few weeks from now.
You bring up a good point, though, about some of these technology companies that are actually getting a boost, like Slack, because people are using it more. I'm also thinking about the use of Amazon and other key delivery services and these streaming services like Netflix. Just wondering, it's so hard to say, as you said, we're in the beginning stages, but perhaps this might cement a trend toward e-commerce and that competitive advantage those companies have over these brick-and-mortar businesses.
It's very, very possible. I think the e-commerce companies, and this is true of some of the same-day food delivery and other services that have, you know, are seeing stronger demand, they have really challenging back-end logistics to figure out, too, as they figure out how are their employees going to go to work? What are their delivery schedules? Are they going to modify those schedules? So, for instance, you know, Amazon's same-day delivery service has just seen surging demand in recent weeks and is basically saying we don't have any windows available right now. So I think it's really unclear, you know, how operational they'll be able to be with all that they're managing.
Yeah. And as for those workers who are working from home, I mean, optimistically, eventually they will go back to their offices. But do you think we might actually see, it's kind of a proof of concept, that these companies can maintain sizable portions of their workforce working from home after this is over?
Possibly. Before the virus in the Bay Area, there was a push towards remote work. Who knows what's going to happen to the economic picture here? That was really driven by the high cost of housing in the Bay Area. But with that trend underway, coupled with this, I think we could see some major shifts in realignment in the workforce.
That's Jessica Lessen, Editor-in-Chief of The Information. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
We mentioned earlier that parts of California have now been ordered to take steps like Italy by putting down shelter-in-place orders. That means 7 million people from 7 counties in Northern California are being asked to not only leave their homes for essential travel for at least 3 weeks. California Governor Gavin Newsom is also advising all Californians to stop gathering in groups no matter the size.
Directing that no gatherings be considered advanced in this state. That's the new guideline we're putting out this evening as well. And we think it's very rational under these circumstances. Disruptive, I know, for some, but rational.
More than 500 people have tested positive for the coronavirus in the state. Marisa Lagos is a correspondent for KQED in San Francisco, and she joins us now from her home. Hi, Marisa.
Hey, Tanya.
So break down for us what a shelter-in-place order actually means. Is it similar to Italy and other places in Europe that we were talking about?
Yeah, I think we're a little bit, maybe a few weeks behind Italy. This is really a directive from local officials here in the Bay Area. And what they're asking people to do is essentially just sort of stick to their household, stay inside unless you need to go to the grocery store or go to a doctor, do something absolutely essential. They're really urging people not to, you know, make a run on groceries, that there are plenty of supplies here, but they're really just trying to distance us from each other. And I mean, it's been an interesting week. Tanya, as you know, I have two young children and schools are not in session. And we had decided as a household actually to do this ourselves as of Sunday. And so I think in some ways it's a little bit of a relief to have this directive from the local officials so we know exactly what the parameters are, but it's definitely challenging.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. It brings guidance. And I think a lot of people, though, were asking what exactly is essential travel. And you brought this up if you have a doctor's appointment or something like that. But grocery shopping is not under that rubric of essential travel. I'm also wondering, though.
Yeah, so we're allowed to go to the grocery store. And we are actually allowed to go outside and take a walk. My kids are out on their scooters and bikes right now, as long as you stay 6 feet away from people who aren't in your household.
I see. How are authorities going to enforce this?
Well, they're hoping that it's more of a guidance issue. Technically, if you violate an order like this, a public health order, you could be cited for a misdemeanor, but that's obviously not what anybody wants to see. What we're hearing from our police chief here and from the mayor is that city officials, police will be out there kind of educating people at this point. And unless somebody is really sort of defying this in a ridiculous way, they're not going to be, you know, citing people. They're just going to be trying to explain to them what we're asking for.
Yeah, you're at home. You've been at home for a couple of days. You put this order in place for your household. But what does the Bay Area look like right now? Are the streets empty? Is the interstate empty?
Yeah, it is really eerie and strange. The kind of closest thing I can think of in recent history is the wildfires when the smoke was keeping everybody inside. But it's certainly a little further than that. You know, my corner is usually very busy in the morning with honks and beeps. And except for the street sweepers and the buses still running, it really does feel like everyone's hunkering down.
Yeah. All non-essential businesses have also closed. Do you know what measures the state is taking to keep those small business owners and employees afloat?
Yeah, we've seen a pretty aggressive sort of move from Sacramento in recent days. Just last night, the state legislature decided, before they adjourned until April 13th, to pass up to $1 billion in aid packages. And that's really more for hospitals and to support, you know, seniors who are homebound and individuals who might need that help. We've also seen waiving of, you know, the waiting period for unemployment insurance. In San Francisco, the city is offering a $10 million to help essentially subsidize sick leave for small employers. So if they can offer it for a week, but they need help with the second week, things like that. So I do think that people are really trying to step up as much as possible. I think right now, some of the challenge is probably just getting that information out to people and making sure they understand what they're eligible for.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned that you're at home with your children. I'm also thinking about childcare workers who really rely on that work. Have you heard anything about those workers?
Well, I mean, we're still paying our preschool tuition, and we're getting a lot of emails from our teachers who are trying to still do their part to educate. I know part of this order is to essentially say, unless you're a live-in nanny or you need to help somebody with medical care, that you cannot go and do your job. And so I think that, you know, the question is, for those of us who are still getting our paychecks, what can we do to keep the sort of economy going and moving? And can you afford to still pay people, even if you're not getting your house cleaned or, you know, your child care taken care of? But I mean, that juggle is really this big challenge, Tanya. I think you're in the same situation where it's like, how do we work and homeschool our kids and sort of present them with a sense of normalcy in this weird time?
Yeah. Yeah. All of us are doing it. Yes. I'm in my closet and my kids are downstairs. So we're all grappling with those questions. That's KQED's Marisa Lagos, with us from San Francisco. Thank you so much for your time.
Take care, Tanya.
Well, as we mentioned, kids are home because schools across the nation are closing to stop the spread of coronavirus. In Wisconsin, the government has mandated that all schools close beginning tomorrow. But before that, one school there has been using data about the virus as a teaching tool. Emily Files of member station UWM visited a classroom where for weeks middle schoolers have been analyzing coronavirus statistics.
Eastbrook Academy is a small K-12 Christian school on the north side of Milwaukee. Eighth graders here say they heard about the coronavirus on TikTok, the social media video app. Here's Noah Keller.
It's kind of like over-exaggerated. They kind of make it into like a apocalypse, end of the world thing.
Math teacher Bill Drewliner says the students brought their concern into the classroom.
There was a lot of alarm. Sometimes it's hard to tell whether the kids are joking or not. There was either concern or fake concern that was coming out in the way they were talking about it. You know, can we talk about coronavirus instead of, you know, solving linear equations or things like that?
This was back in mid-February when the virus was mostly confined to China. Drewliner saw it as a learning opportunity. So for the past 3 weeks, his class has studied the coronavirus infection data and calculated the rate of growth. Student Mariah Guire says it became more significant for her once the outbreak reached the U.S. She's worried about relatives in Wisconsin and other states.
For me, it's creepy or like scary because I have family like everywhere. So it's just like every state there is, they're like, oh yeah, your blah, blah, blah lives there. And I'm like, whoa, they might get it.
After looking at the numbers in one recent class, Drew Liner asked students what recommendations they would tell the CDC. Kia Osterwind raised her hand.
Yes, Kia.
To not stop so many planes. Maybe there's a food shipment, and then if we do need to quarantine everyone in the house, we need to have food.
Patrick Honor says using real-life examples can make math concepts more accessible, and coronavirus is as real as it gets. Honor teaches at New York City's Stuyvesant High School and wrote a coronavirus statistics lesson for other teachers to use.
Teachers are always looking for ways to make math real for their students, and you know this, the coronavirus is very real. So the students are curious because they know that this can affect them.
Honor says teachers need to be sensitive to the fact that the conversation can be scary for students.
That's where the expertise of a teacher knowing their students really is important, because you have that relationship with them and you understand, you know, what will be appropriate for them and what might be too much.
Biology teacher Megan Christensen wanted her students to know the reality of the situation. She teaches in Upland, California, near L.A. Christensen had her ninth graders research how viruses like COVID-19 infect cells. Soon they'll write papers about solutions to viral outbreaks.
We need to teach students about what is important. We need to teach students about real-world problems and how to figure things out, because that is what happens when you're an adult.
The teachers hope their lessons about the coronavirus help their students feel better informed, even as news about the spread of it grows more concerning. For NPR News, I'm Emily Files in Milwaukee.
And let's learn more now about Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's announcement today at the White House Task Force on the coronavirus that the administration wants to put money in the hands of Americans.
We're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. And what we've heard from hardworking Americans, many companies have now shut down, whether it's bars or restaurants. Americans need cash now, and the president wants to get cash now. And I mean now, in the next 2 weeks.
And this is part of a plan from the administration for an $850 billion stimulus package. Many economists have been saying, yes, put cash in the hands of Americans, especially those out of work because of the coronavirus. Then there's the Federal Reserve cut to interest rates to make it easier to borrow and spend. But our next guest says, well, the Fed can only do so much. Let's bring in economist Stephen Roach, senior fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs, also former chair of Morgan Stanley Asia. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Robin.
And how briefly do you feel about just flat-out cash to Americans?
Look, it's an admirable thing to help Americans who are suffering. I'd rather, quite honestly, put cash in the hands of scientists and public health officials to get a grip on this crisis immediately. And I heard the emphasis that Secretary Mnuchin places on getting cash to people in distress. I'm not critical of that, but I really want to see disease containment get the same emphasis from our Treasury Secretary that he's giving today at the White House.
Well, this is your main point, your overarching point, that it's time to invest in scientific findings, long-term resilience against emerging diseases and climate change. But it sounds like you're saying, as many others have, it would be very nice to give, you know, a couple thousand to every American, especially those out of work, so that they can pay their mortgage, and then they can cover some food. But what do you do next month? So you're saying, you know, think of the long term. And that brings us to the Fed cut, which again makes it easier to borrow and spend. Now, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow predicted a short economic slowdown of just weeks and months. But you write, large economies around the world have been slowing, you know, they were slowing before the virus. Too many governments, you say, made a devil's compact with globalization, prioritizing speed and quantity of economic growth over quality. What do you mean there?
Well, what's the quality of the growth experience? Having cleaner air, having a planet that is more stable in terms of the hole in the ozone error, and also making certain that we don't have disease rampant around the world in a public health infrastructure that is ill-equipped, incapable of responding to that disease. So we have overlooked that because we want faster growth, cheaper goods and services from producers around the world, and that's a very unfortunate aspect of the compact that we have underpinning globalization today.
Yeah, and you say that this is a supply shock that we're in right now with the effects of the coronavirus. So, for instance, we can't get, you know, manufacturers can't get things they need because of factories shut down in China. It's not a demand shock, you know, with people afraid to spend money, and that's when you pour money into the economy, you know, to make it grow. So
that's an oversimplification.
Oh, sure is. It sure is.
You know, it's a supply shock coming out of China, but it certainly has implications for demand if people are restricted from leaving their homes and fearful of assembly in public places. So,
it's becoming a demand shock.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we hear you about you and others saying it's time to invest in things long term to prepare for future outbreaks, and there will be more viruses, and there will be climate change. But what would you suggest short-term for people who suddenly woke up Monday morning and they're out of a job because their company can no longer have, you know, people coming in to work out in a gym or people coming in to sit down at a restaurant? What's the best thing to do there?
The best thing to do there is take care of yourself. If you don't have work, if you have absolutely no cash on hand, then, you know, we have social services and public authorities who should be able to get you what you need to subsist on a short-term basis. But I don't think that, you know, the full force of the U.S. government right now should be provided, should be focused on providing income assistance for those in distress. We need to provide direct assistance to the scientific and public health community who can get a grip on this problem. If we don't solve COVID-19 over the next few weeks, then we're going to have a far more serious set of economic dislocations to address in the months. And
even more pain. But even, you know, expanding, and just we only have a couple seconds, but even expanding unemployment?
You know, again, I'm in favor of providing short-term relief for those in the most acute distress, but that should not be the sole focus of a public policy coming out of Washington.
Stephen Roach, Senior Fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute of Global Affairs. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.